Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on location and on a telephone today, because I'm not where I have access to the internet. We're going to be talking, of course, about health and healing. But then we have a lot of very interesting and diverse audio clips to share with you. And you'll have an opportunity later in the program to call in and share your points of view. And we've had some very interesting and well-articulated discussions this week by people in the audience. So our number to call in on is 888-874-4888. I'm going to begin going right into health and nutrition early because some of these audio clips are a little longer than normal. First off, for those of you who eat fish, the healthiest fish is the fatty fish. And according to the University of Eastern Finland, fatty fish and camelina, that's C-A-M-E-L-I-N-A oil, you probably haven't heard of it before, are beneficial for your cholesterol levels, keeping them in the good range and enhancing the best cholesterol. So eating fatty fish increases the size and lipid composition of the HDL, the high-density lipoprotein, particles in people with impaired glucose metabolism. That's generally people with diabetes, and that's a lot of people. Now, these changes in the size and lipid composition of HDL particles make them beneficial for cardiovascular health. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Molecular Nutrition and Food Research, and the study also found that camelina stevia oil decreases the number and harmful particles. And so that's what's important, just two good things to make sure you have healthier cholesterol and a healthier heart. And that's giving you the omega-3 fatty acids. And the camelina oil is rich in alpha-linolenic acid, which is an essential omega-3 fatty acid. And that's the linolenic acid helps stabilize your heart and helps your heart overall. It's just really good. So that's that study. Also, something that's puzzled people for a long time. If a mother is depressed, what is the likelihood that that will impact upon her child? And historically, we've been told, well, it won't impact them at all. Eventually, the mother gets over her depression. The child's not affected. But according to the University of California, San Diego, we have roughly 10% of all women in the United States will experience depression. And the consequences, contrary to what we've been told, will extend to their children. And they found that a mother's depression can negatively affect a child's cognitive development up to the age of 16. Now, the results were published in the current issue of Child Development. And they looked at 900 healthy children and their mothers living in Santiago, Chile, after a five-year interval from the child's infancy through the age of 16. And they observed how affectionate and responsive mothers were to their children at each age of life, as well as how much mothers provided age-appropriate learning materials. And what they found was that if a mother is going through depression, the child begins to have verbal cognitive problems, and then they also do worse on IQ tests, and that's because they're picking up what science did not recognize, which is what is known as the epigenetic, or epa meaning larger environment, the genes. So the environment that you're in, the people in that environment, how healthy or unhealthy, how happy or sad, how angry or calm they are, directly impacts everyone else in that environment. And so the idea that you can be a happy person in an unhappy environment, a healthy person in a toxic environment, that doesn't play hard and true as we had historically been led to believe. We are impacted both positively and negatively to the emotions of the other people in the environments in which we live. also from the University College London, a mother's diet before conception affects a child's health. Now, I've been saying this a long time. In fact, I remember talking with a group of women in a health support group who had been infertile. No matter what they've tried, they were not able to conceive. And so we first did the obvious. We went through all the things that could adversely affect a man's sperm, alcohol and chemicals in the food, and got the men on a very pure, healthy diet, then detoxified them from heavy metals like mercury in the teeth and lead, and got the chelation going. And generally chelation either with EDTA, which is a chemical that goes in the body and it binds to heavy metals and takes it out through the urine, or natural chelation, such as alpha-lipoic acid, vitamin C, the chlorophyll from chlorella or spirulina. Those all have a capacity to grab the heavy metals and take them out. Not as powerful as if you were to do EDTA, but certainly powerful enough. And over a period of 2 years, by detoxifying the male and enhancing the sperm, and by detoxifying the female and enhancing her ovaries and reproductive system, the vast majority of the women were able to conceive healthy children. Now, if you look at the rationale here, if a person who is unhealthy at some level is able to reverse that and get healthy, then imagine what would happen if a person is unhealthy. Let's say they don't pay attention to their diet. They eat the typical American diet, high in refined carbohydrates and sugars and too much animal protein, lots of preservatives. That means then that you're going to be causing problems. And this is exactly what this study from the University College London showed, that a child's health can be compromised not only by a mother who smokes or drinks during pregnancy, but if she's overweight, if she's obese, if she has a poor diet. And if both parents are toxic before they procreate, then you really have a child entering the world with a lot of, let's say, genetic predispositions. So that's just the latest one on this very topic. Also, when we're looking at foods that heal and foods that cause disease, we have to be looking at the cruciferous vegetables because they're really the superstars. And it was about 10 years ago that we learned that broccoli sprouts, which are very easy to sprout, you can sprout them all day long on your kitchen table, they are very beneficial. Now, we knew they were beneficial because of two chemicals, indole-3-carbinol, or I3C, and the isothiocyanates. These are natural sulfur-based chemicals in the food that helps detoxify the body, but also helps prevent cells from mutating, cancers from spreading, even the protection against cancer. So that's why most people eat their cruciferous, broccoli, cauliflower, kale. But now we have new information that adds to the benefit of eating these broccoli sprouts. They're good for diabetics. That's correct. Broccoli sprouts can boost antioxidant defenses in people with diabetes, and this was a randomized clinical trial. So according to the findings published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition, by eating about 10 grams of broccoli, and that's not a lot, that's a small amount, but if you ate 10 grams of broccoli sprouts a day, you would flood the body with antioxidants that would be in your blood, and that would reduce what is known as MDA. MDA is this maladonyl dialdehyde. It's a reactive carbonyl compound as well as a well-established marker for oxidative stress. So this is just a study showing that the tissues of cruciferous vegetables, which should be lightly steamed, open those tissues up to allow the nutrients and the water inside to come out, cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, they contain high levels of the active compound that is called a glucosinolate. And these are metabolized by the body into isothiocyanates, and which are well-known antioxidants and powerful anti-carcinogens. And the main isothiocyanate from broccoli is sulforaphane. There's your sulfur group. I'm just giving a little bit more science because some people in the audience are dietitians, nutritionists, holistic nurses, doctors. They like to be able to pass on more definitive information. For the average person, they don't need the science. They just, broccoli's helped me, I'll eat broccoli. So the broccoli sprouts are one of the richest sources of a compound, which is in a sulforaphane glucosinolate, and it is called glucoraphaelin, and it contains 50 times more mature nutrient than the broccoli, eating broccoli by itself. So the takeaway message is this. Eat your broccoli. It's good. Eat broccoli sprouts. They're 50 times more powerful. And also it helps reduce oxidative stress in the body. And that helps prevent disease of all types because oxidative stress is a major cause of disease, and especially in diabetes. For those women, according to the University of California Health System at Davis, who start prenatal vitamin early, you're far less likely to have a child with autism. And if a woman does not take any vitamins early on in their pregnancy, you are twice as likely to have a child with autism. So that's very important. I suggest taking a full-spectrum, high-quality, multiple vitamin mineral and supplement it with additional coenzyme Q10, cayenne, and that will make a difference. But stay away, in my opinion. I believe that most of the very cheap vitamins you're getting, they're cheap for a reason. They're synthetic. They have low potencies, too low to really make a functional difference in the body. I was recently, just completing today, a retreat to help our sister station, WBAI. Looks like we are going to be able to purchase around 1,000 premiums and get them out immediately that people otherwise would not have gotten. So the retreat was very beneficial, but it was very beneficial for the people. In fact, right after this program, I will be, before they leave today, I'm having them go, just those who want, go to a telephone and say, here's what happened. And you're going to hear some absolutely remarkable, almost unbelievable stories. In fact, there are several physicians here, but one physician said, had I not come at the urging of my daughter, I don't listen to you, I don't know anything about you, but she's always saying, Gary suggests this or Gary suggests that, and I just got tired of hearing her say that. So I would not have believed what I've seen. I can't explain it, but it just seems too many changes happening in such a short period of time, and I'm watching this. And I said, go back in medical school. That was about 30 years ago for this guy. I said, how many courses did you have in body-mind medicine? Well established by Dr. Benson at Harvard and Professor Hans Selye and others who've contributed over 3,000 articles in the peer-reviewed literature on how your mind, positive or negative, in your thoughts, directly impact your biochemistry. We didn't have any. I said, what about in-depth classes on nutrition and nutritional biochemistry and how it impacts your brain and your heart? Didn't have any. All right, how about the impact of our environment? All of the 100,000-plus human-made chemicals that we're inhaling, about 124 pounds of industrial chemicals and pollutants per year per person. Not one of those is beneficial. They're all toxic. Never had any of those classes. How about a class on proper digestion? Understanding how when you chew properly, when you masticate your food, amylase and ptyalin, two enzymes, are secreted from underneath your tongue to insalivate your food. And that's where digestion starts. And that's why just chewing and gulping down or drinking something down with what you're chewing really harms digestion and causes a much more incomplete digestion. Never had a class on digestion. Did you ever have a class on how the body can get a good night's sleep or how it's prevented from having a night's sleep? Nope. Any studies that you had on stress and cortisol and epinephrine impacting your immune system? Nope. So I went down a list of 50 different topics that everyone in this audience knows something about. And this person never had a course in it. So unless they learned outside of class, which is possible but rare, they wouldn't have known this. So what we have is a single monotheistic educational system for doctors and nurses, and where it's very beneficial, and I absolutely support it when it comes to emergency medicine. If you have a heart attack or stroke, you got your tooth knocked out, you got an eye injury, you got burned, we're really good for helping save that person's life. But it's the chronic care that we fail at, and that's about 85% of all medicine. Diabetes, arthritis, cancer, heart disease, inflammatory conditions. We fail miserably. I'd like to share now something from Harvard Medical School, published in PLOS ONE Medicine and reported in Science Daily. Quote, medical students have substantial exposure to pharmaceutical industry marketing. Medical students in the United States are frequently exposed to pharmaceutical marketing even in their preclinical years, and the extent of their contact with industry is associated with positive attitudes about marketing and skepticism towards any negative implications. These findings from research led by Kristen Austed and Aaron Kesselbehan from Harvard Medical School suggest that strategies to educate students about interactions with pharmaceutical industry should directly address widely held misconceptions about the effects of marketing. The authors examined all published studies on this topic and collected the results from 9,850 medical students in 76 medical schools. And the authors found that most students had some form of interaction with the pharmaceutical industry, and the contact increased in the clinical years with up to 90%, that's 90% of all clinical students receiving some form of educational materials from the pharmaceutical industry. Most students thought it was ethically permissible to accept gifts from drug manufacturers and justified their entitlement to gifts by citing financial hardships or by asserting that most other students accepted gifts also, why not them? Also, two-thirds of students reported that they were immune to bias induced by promotion, gifts, or interactions. Students' opinions were split on whether physician industry interactions should be regulated either by medical schools or the government. So here's what this means, and it's just be very pragmatic about it. When you walk into a doctor's office, let's say you walk into the office of a oncologist, that oncologist, for example, in California, has the right to suggest chemotherapy. Now, whether there's actual science from a peer review, real gold standard, a placebo versus none, almost always it's one chemotherapy against another chemotherapy. That's not a placebo. That's not a double-blind study. That's a fraudulent study. And that's most of what they do. But if you had 1,000 patients who had pancreatic cancer and you gave them a healthy diet, healthy lifestyle, lots of good nutrition and exercise and positive reinforcement, that would be a legitimate group. To give people a very typical bad diet, the diet that's caused their cancer, and no exercise, and put them in a situation where they feel hopeless and stressed, that's not a placebo on any level. And then another group could give the chemotherapy agent. But if you took the chemotherapy and you took the healthy lifestyle person and you followed them for 5 years to see how many lived, what was the quality of their life during that period of time, what other conditions developed because of their healthy lifestyle or because of the chemotherapy, that's legitimate. That's never, ever, ever been done in the history of cancer research. And they know better than to do that. That would be the kiss of death for the entire cancer fraudulent industry. But they're not going to do it. And they know why. That's the kind of comparison they don't want. So let's say that a drug that you're going to get every month for, let's say, 24 months, the manufacturer charges the physician directly $5,000. The physician charges you $12,000. The physician's made $7,000 per month. Let's make it simple, 100 patients. All right. If you're making 7,000 times 100 per month, that's $700,000 a month. That does not include any of their expenses, hospitalization, the in-clinic expenses. And let's just say that at the end of a year, you've made an extra almost $8 million. What is the incentive for you to look for other therapies that would not be financially rewarding to you? And yet, where we have greed permeating every industry, when a legislator does it, takes all that money, and then votes for an NRA bill, or votes for Monsanto, or making mandatory vaccines, or votes after getting money from the military-industrial complex to go into countries and regime change or start wars. There, everyone, no matter what your political persuasion, will say, yeah, clearly, money shouldn't have been allowed in the hands of any politician since they're all sociopaths to begin with. You all know that. I know it. We all know that. You know, occasionally you might have a good one, and we've had some good ones, but they're in the minority. But the majority are corrupt, and they're generally anyone. Let me put it this way. Anyone who needs power gained from other people is the last person who should have any power. And the people who don't want power over the people are never given a position of power. We've never, ever in the country's history voted into office anyone at any level who came from a spiritual background, not a religious background, that's utterly corrupting, a spiritual background. But when it comes to doctors and medicine, we just can't take that step forward to accept that maybe the money they're making has in any way contributed to their bias in how they select a therapy or what they're not willing to look at. And that is a shame on us moment, because this year over 530,000 Americans will die from cancer, but we refuse to accept how many will die because the treatment itself causes cancer. Radiation and chemotherapy are both strong carcinogen progenitors causing cancer. We will refuse to accept that when someone dies of diarrhea and is cachexic, they were not affected by diarrhea and they were not wasting away prior to the chemotherapy. It's one of the side effects. You can also have it with radiation. One of my closest friends, Jerry Krupman, a really outstanding photographer, went to the VA, and they gave him massive amounts of radiation, a number of treatments that just you would never imagine. And when he called me, I said, tell him to stop. And they said, well, they're doing it preventatively. So I said, so there's no cancer. No, the cancer's out. But you keep going back every week and getting more radiation. Stop it. Don't do it, Jerry. But he didn't. And then about 3 months later, he shows up. I was down in Texas, the Healing Springs Ranch. And he said he couldn't hold any food down. and because of radiation sickness. And every single thing that he tried didn't work, and so he just kept losing weight, losing electrolytes, dehydrating. And I worked with him and started to get him to, you know, to get some food to stabilize in there, mainly in liquid form, and it had to be literally sipped, like one tablespoon at a time. But he was my close friend, and I worked with him. And then one day, when I went over to get him in the morning, he wasn't there. Didn't know where he went. Had no idea. And I only heard later that he had gone into Dallas, the hospital, because he felt he was a burden. And so he went once again to the VA, and they gave him medications, and he died. I've had so many of my family and friends die of cancer who didn't have to. So when it comes to challenging that part of medicine that does not work, I'm going to. And if people feel uncomfortable about that, or doctors resent the fact that someone actually will stand up and challenge them where appropriate, and they can't handle that, that's an issue we should openly discuss in our society. Because then I decided to put some energy into this to see, was this just an isolated case or two, or was this more? And in the process, I brought in four people, all of whom I knew and were friends with, who were all academic medical doctors, meaning they just weren't doctors. They also had the ability to study the scientific literature, had taught medical schools, and were very smart. These are bright, 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 bright people. And they're very, 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 very patient. So we took 5 years to study the medical literature, only using peer-reviewed literature, only using statements that have been confirmed and not controversial from the National Academy of Sciences, Library of Medicine, and the associations themselves, the American College of Physicians and Surgeons, only using their statistics, none else. And at the end of 5 years, we published our results in a paper, and I labeled it Death by Medicine. And we sent it out to 7,000 medical and scientific publications and over 5,000 media outlets. Not one single person reported on it. Now that is really something that is remarkable. So what I'm going to do is, beginning in the next month, I'm updating the materials now. We have an outside medical biostatistician reviewing for accuracy any newer material, because it would be 5 years out of date. But at that time, the number one cause of death from all causes, more than heart attack or stroke or diabetes or cancer, was your medical doctor. And in that year, we gave the most conservative figures, was 700,000, but the more realistic figure was 1 million people died. And the most were injured. In 1 year, 9 million Americans were injured by medicine. We then took it back 20 years and found that over 14 million Americans died at the hands of medicine. Now, these were all compliant people. None of this was alternative medicine. So let me ask you this question. I'd like your feedback on this on TalkBack. I don't know if I can get TalkBack because I'm on the same line that I'll be asking you to call in, because I'm on a telephone today because I don't have the internet access right now where I'm at. In any case, here's the question for all of you. If we had 14 million Americans die over 20 years in plane wrecks, in car accidents, or poisoned death by eating food, like hamburgers, would we do anything about it? Would it make the news? Would there be any panels at the state, national level? Would associations within medicine begin to question the efficacy and safety of their protocols? Would anything change? What if you had 14 million Americans who that owned firearms die because the firearms exploded, no matter what it was, a handgun or a machine gun. It exploded and killed them. Would there be any meeting about changing the safety of that gun? So here's the deal. If we're willing to be critical of even five people or two people dying of salmonella and recall everything from a Chili's restaurant, and we have 14 million people, I call that medical genocide, and yet not a single meeting, not a single effort to change it. In fact, nothing whatsoever changed. Business as usual. Then what does that tell us about the medical-industrial complex, the media that covers it, the scientific literature that promotes it, the medical schools that teach it, and the doctors who perform it? What exactly does that tell you? Or are we not still willing to acknowledge that the number one murderers in America is the medical establishment? And they're rewarded for it, they're praised for it, and they're esteemed for it. Now, how do you wrap your mind around that? If you can call in, and if my engineer can get the call through, I'd like to hear from you, please. Our number is 888-874-4888. Now, I have some audio clips. Unfortunately, because I'm not at my computer and we select our audio clips a month in advance for each show, we're going to play you some, though I can't give you the exact title, but you understand what they're about. They're self-explanatory. But the one is by an O'Neill. And O'Neill is this firebrand Irish commentator. He's one of these in-your-face people, but boy, does he lay some points that we can agree or disagree with, but I believe that we need to hear these so we can discuss or debate the issues he's addressing that are not being discussed or debated openly and fairly and honestly and objectively by anyone in the mainstream media. We'll take his clip first.
Thank you very much. 700 years ago, if someone had come to Oxford and stood here and said, I think everyone should be allowed to read the Bible, even peasants, that person would have been described as offensive. He would have been denounced, shouted at, and eventually no platformed. That was certainly the experience of John Wycliffe. In 1382, he was banished from Oxford for, among other things, translating the Bible into English. His work was described as an offence against the ecclesiastical order. 200 years ago, if someone had come to Oxford and stood here and said, I don't believe in God, that person would have been described as offensive. He would have been ridiculed, yelled at. That was certainly the experience of Shelley, who in 1811 was banished from Oxford for writing a pamphlet called The Necessity of Atheism. One historical account describes how Shelley's pamphlet caused maximum offence. It describes how fellows and students at New College swept the pamphlets up and disposed of them, much like today's students sweep up copies of The Sun, which they also describe as causing maximum offence. 100 years ago, if someone had come to Oxford and stood here and said, I think a man should be allowed to have sex with another man, that person would have been described as offensive. He would have been booed, hissed at, no platformed. That was certainly the experience of The Chameleon, an openly gay Oxford magazine which in 1894 survived for one issue only. Why? Because it was offensive. One observer described it as an insult to the animal creation. and said it would have a dangerous influence. In other words, it made Oxford an unsafe space, and it had to be stopped. Much as today's student leaders ban lads mags in the name of preserving safe spaces for students. So when today's student leaders clamp down on offensive stuff, they're actually carrying on a very long tradition. A tradition whereby the creme de la creme of British society take it upon themselves to police the parameters of acceptable thought and to exclude offensiveness from the academy. Throughout history, the church, politicians, universities have always branded certain ideas offensive and have waged war against them. Today, student leaders do the same. They carry out one of the oldest, foulest forms of intolerance, intolerance of anyone who gives offence. But giving offence is good. In fact, it's essential. Humans have long had the urge to offend against the natural order, the religious order, the moral order, and in the process, they have pushed humanity forward. In fact, pretty much every leap forward in history, pretty much every freedom we enjoy, is a product of individuals having given offence, having offended against the orthodoxies of their age. Offensiveness is not just something we have to begrudgingly accept. Offensiveness is the motor of human progress. Copernicus offended Christians when he said the sun was at the centre of the universe. He really hurt them. And in the process, he made the world a better, more understandable place. John Wilkes, the 18th century radical journalist, offended everyone. He packed his newspapers with sex and lies and stories about bishops buggering their maids and so on and so on. And in the process, through his struggles with the authorities, he gave birth to press freedom. The newspaper Gay News caused profound offence to Christians in 1976 when it published a poem about a Roman centurion giving Jesus Christ a blowjob. And in the process, in its struggles with the authorities, it started a debate about the blasphemy laws, which eventually led to their abolition, expanding freedom of speech for all of you, for everyone.
Question.
No. The right to offend... The right to offend is not some pesky little part of freedom of speech that we have to put up with. It is the heart and soul and lungs of freedom of speech. It is the coursing lifeblood of human progress. It is the instigator of liberty and modernity and science and understanding. What a laughing stock today's student leaders are, that they can so casually dismiss the right to be offensive without realizing that their lovely, enlightened lives are the gift of individuals who gave offense. The gift of scientists, thinkers, agitators who bravely showed their asses to the dominant ideas of their era. Their offensiveness made you free. I know what some student leaders will say. Oh, but our no platforming is about protecting individuals. We only want to protect women from misogyny and black students from racism. So our intolerance is progressive. Please, how progressive is it to say that female students are so fragile that they can't cope with seeing a pair of tits in the sun? No, without falling apart. That doesn't sound progressive. To me, that sounds paternalistic. How progressive is it to say that black students need these wise white student leaders to protect them from harmful ideas? Because that doesn't sound progressive to me. That sounds neo-colonialist. The fact is, today's student leaders aren't protecting individuals, they're protecting an idea, and it is the most mainstream status quo idea of the 21st century, the idea of human vulnerability, the poisonous notion that humans are fragile and therefore our speech and our relations must be monitored and policed. It is this misanthropic, orthodox idea that they promote and which they protect from criticism as surely as priests once ring-fenced their beliefs from ridicule. In this choking climate, we have got to move beyond talking about a right to offend. We have to talk about a duty to offend. Anyone who cares for freedom, anyone who believes that humanity only progresses through being daring and disrespectful, now has a duty to rile and stir and outrage, a duty to break out of the new grey conformism, a duty to ridicule the new guardians of decency, a duty to tell them your orthodoxy.
And you were just listening to Brendan O'Neill in a debate at Oxford University and on freedom of speech and the right to offend. And I agree with that. And the woman who followed him, who believed in censorship and that there should be speech police and that the platforms that we use, like Wikipedia and Google and Facebook, should be censoring anything that is considered insensitive to any individual or group. And she made all the remarks that you would expect someone from that movement to make, as they've been making here in the United States. In fact, I'll be doing a commentary on our next program on what is happening with Google and Facebook, already censoring all over Europe, and in Germany, for example. If you say anything in any platform that someone finds offensive, you're banned from that. And they're doing it now in the United States. In fact, over the next 12 months, I'll be doing over 50 programs, starting on Monday or Tuesday. My team of scholars and residents, my legal team, are reviewing my investigative report, an original investigative report, that I'll be presenting for the entire show. It's that long. It's taken a year to do it at the beginning of the week on the people running these platforms that we use and who they really are and what they're really about and why they're censoring. Right now, more than 200 sites with some of the finest journalists in the world are being censored. In fact, we just spoke with two of these journalists yesterday who agreed that they've been censored, and we've given them a forum, and we're giving all censored authors in America a forum so that every week they will have a forum to share whatever they are working on with an audience. But that's how bad it's getting, and that's what's happening on college students, and the students are just, they're tuned out to the fact that they're being used so that they can then gain something on their platform, but they're then asked to vote in the next elections. Remember, the people who are supporting you in this movement and that movement are the Democrats. And just like the blacks and Latinos were played by the Democrats when they put forth either Hillary or Barack Obama, they were used. Do you think these people in Congress have any care about what you're suffering through? Not at all. Or your freedoms? Not at all. So, yeah, I agree. And just like my death by medicine, it was meant to be an offense against the medical orthodoxy's own arrogance and hubris, where their problem caused 14 million people to die, more than 199 million Americans to be injured, and not one single person was held accountable. So there's a time to speak up, especially when the consequences of not is so dramatic. We're going to go to another clip in a moment on Bill Maher and Abby Martin speaking out. But before that, we have Tim from New Jersey on. Tim, you're on the air. It's your turn.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Good to hear your voice, sir. I didn't get through yesterday, but one aside is that I've got something, and I'll email it to you, having to do with Libya that I think you'll find interesting. And what I wanted to say about the medical-industrial complex is I think it's a very important view for us to take is their link to the perpetuation of the fossil fuel industries, the suppression of the new energies, and a lot of the other new technologies that I think are being kept so that they can maintain this draining on everyone of having to pay them and have their monopolies, so to speak.
Okay, I would suggest that you pull back a little further and see if this makes sense to you. I don't feel that any doctor or anyone in the medical industrial complex gets up each morning and wanting to actively work with any other industry, whether it's the military industrial complex or any of the energy cartels, to protect their monopoly. They don't have to. They've been given absolute total authority for all of our history, at least the last 100 years, to be the only source for medical treatment. And in fact, it is so rigid and so complete that they have state medical boards. And these state medical boards look at every doctor. And if there's any doctor doing anything that is not considered current scientific medical practice or standard of care practice, they can be challenged, charged, or lose their license. You got to pull back further, because the Rockefellers controlled much of American medicine at the beginning of the century, and they did so with the Fleischner Report, where he deemed that all homeopathic schools and any other form of medicine was not subject to a quantified standard. So in came the German school of medicine, which was pharmaceutical, and therefore the Rockefellers controlled much of the pharmaceuticals being used. And to make sure that they maintain that dominance, they created the curriculum, and then the state boards, and then the ruling governors of the American Medical Association that controlled the accreditation of both hospitals and medical schools and nursing schools. So if you wanted to become a doctor, if you wanted to practice medicine, you had to use their standards, and if you didn't, you lost your license. That has maintained itself to today. But that was started over 100 years ago. So now today, I'll give you two examples. Carl Halstead in California, board-certified physician, and he specialized in helping people who had cancer use a better diet and exercise, et cetera, to improve their outcome of whatever therapy they got. There was also a man named Dr. James Privatira. He also was a board-certified physician. He did not treat cancer. He did not dissuade anyone from treating cancer using orthodox methods, radiation, chemotherapy, surgery. Instead, he did post-cancer work. So you would go to your regular oncologist and get whatever standard therapy. You'd have side effects. You would go to him, and he would try to help you overcome those side effects. Both people were charged by the state board. Both lost their license. But Privatira was actually the example they wanted to use. So they took this young, bright physician and charged him with fraud. The fraud was that he was supposed to have realized that by not using standard therapy, he was committing a fraud by suggesting that anything else could help a person with cancer. They put him on trial, so he brought over 240 of his patients into the courtroom who showed that by taking the post-orthodox treatment therapy, mind you, listen to what I said, he did not tell people not to do their therapy. He merely helped them after they had their therapy with nutrition to get healthier and stop their hair from falling out and stop from cachexia and wasting away. The judge decided not to allow a single person to testify on his behalf. Instead, the jury was given this order. If he did not use standard therapy, then he is guilty. He violated the law of the state, the rules. The jury did not want to find him guilty, but they had to, because he said that he did not practice cancer therapy. He merely used nutrition in his medical practice. So based upon that technical statement to the jury, he was found guilty. And the judge not only gave him hard time, but gave him the time he would have if the man had been a killer, a rapist, hard labor on a chain gang breaking rocks. I know this because I'm the one who helped bring his story to the public's attention when his wife came to New York to visit me and I took on his case. That was back in around 1975, 76. And in time, we made such a huff and puff about it, and my show was syndicated all over America and in California, and we got the governor, Governor Brown, to suspend his sentence, but after he'd been out there for over a year. In every single case in every state, the state medical boards, in my personal opinion, act like SS troops. These are the worst of the worst human beings that you could imagine. They're trolls, medical trolls with a license to destroy any doctor's reputation who is doing innovative, important nutrition work or health work. I've seen what they did to Stanislav Brzezinski. In fact, the public may not know this, but I got a call from a patient of Dr. Brzezinski. I didn't even know Brzezinski. I'd never heard of him. And saying, my doctor is keeping a lot of us alive, and this woman in particular, but they're going after him, they're harassing him, they're trying to take away his license. So I didn't know that. I called the guy and talked with him, and he had all the regular credentials, MD, PhD, Baylor College, national grants, and working on these particular ways the body's own immune system can help it with neoplasms. So I did my investigation, found out the local county medical board was doing things against their own bylaws. So I called the guy, head of the board, and I challenged him. And because of that, they pulled back. I wrote a story on him, and it was the first article I've written about Brzezinski. And from that, I got a call from Judy Moses, executive producer of 2020. And she said, I read your article, and can you show me more? And she came over and spent a couple of days, and I showed her two gigantic cases of files I had in tapings. And that caused a special, which won two Emmys, to be done on Dr. Brzezinski, where they were forced to back off from him. They wouldn't take away his license. Now a light came on. And remember, cockroaches run when the lights are on in the kitchen. And so they backed off, so Brzezinski was able to save his license, go ahead and help a lot of people with his anti-neoplastums. Same with true with Dr. Lawrence Burton. Burton was helping cure people, along with Dr. Hillencastle and others on his team, Dr. Rutino, and they went after him, destroyed his reputation. I went after them and exposed these punks, and then I got a call from, in fact, his sister. I just filmed her today. Just filmed her sister, Susan Crowell. Susan is a substantial artist and a professor, and her brother was a producer for 60 Minutes and did the movie Charlie Wilson's War with Julie Roberts and Tom Hanks about the truth of America supporting the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Anyhow, they did a special based on my work on Dr. Lawrence Burton, and that got them off his case, got his clinic open back up again. So this is something very personal to me because my entire career, Robert Atkins, Warren Levin, I can name you Carl Humiston, Robert Vance, dozens of doctors have been attacked by the state medical boards for not using current standard practice, and the issue was not are you healing patients, they all were. Are you getting them well? They all were. Are you doing the right thing? They all were. But that's not what the doctors cared about, nor the medical community cared about, nor the state boards of the AMA. They all cared about not losing control, not allowing the institution to be threatened, having absolute 100% dominant control over the entire field of healthcare. In fact, who do you think gave the documents, secret documents in the AMA, that caused the lawsuits, that caused the AMA to lose the only time in its history, back in the 1970s, to lose a lawsuit that went clear of the Supreme Court and their guilt was upheld by the Supreme Court for the violating the Sherman Antitrust Act and restraint of trade by trying to destroy all alternative therapies with chiropractors and homeopaths, everyone. And they were doing it from the basement with a secret group of 60 people working there for 25 years. That's the AMA. Did anyone expose them in the New York Times? No, a little tiny article in the back. The 11 largest medical organizations in America were also found guilty. Their guilt was upheld at the Supreme Court. So one of the reasons chiropractic, the entire field of chiropractic, exists today is because of that lawsuit. If it hadn't, there would be no chiropractor left in the United States. Not one. Not one. It would be dead. It was dying. The stake was almost in its heart because in the medical canons of ethics, the official canons of ethics of the AMA, every doctor in the United States had to accept and agree that chiropractic was an unscientific cult. You could not receive a patient from a chiropractor, nor could you recommend a patient to a chiropractor. It was so bad that in one of the million documents uncovered under discovery, a doctor was in a country club and went to the state medical board to say, should I resign my position in the country club because I found out there is a chiropractor who also has a member there, and I don't want to end up in a locker room and maybe the guy talks to me at some point and jeopardize my medical career. That's how paranoid the entire medical community was about associating with quackery. And the so-called quackbusters were all themselves, in my opinion, the nut jobs of the century. But who did the New York Times and who did Jane Brody, the New York Times, and other people call themselves journalists, who did they quote? Did they quote the doctors curing people? Not once. They would quote the quackbusters like Stephen Barrett, people who've been absolutely discredited. And if you'll know about how discredited he is because he's in my report next week. So you see, we have a war going on. And that war is between those who care about freedom of choice and the AMA and its entire dominance of the entire medical field. There is no freedom of choice in medicine. And we've got to get up to where we understand that and the consequences of what that means to our lives and health. That's why you have mandatory vaccines. That's why any doctor who cures a patient but doesn't use standard medical care could lose their license. That's how bad it is. Tim, I appreciate you calling in and sharing your points of view. Does that make it any, give you a little broader perspective on it? Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. And yeah, you bet. I'm going to be getting in the face and doing all I can to get the attention of those who I feel have violated our sacred trust in them. Have a nice day, everyone.